if we set standards and hold ourselves to them, there's no way that we're not contributing in a greater way to everything in which we are involved.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Helping with Dr. Richard Schuster. Food for the brain, knowledge from the experts, tools to win at life. I'm your host, Dr. Richard. Whoever you are, wherever you're from, and whatever you do, this is the show that is going to help you become the best version of yourself. Each episode, you will hear from some of the most amazing, talented, and successful people on the planet who followed their passions and strive to help others. Join our movement to get 1 million people each day to commit acts of kindness for others. Together, we're going to make the world a better place. Are you ready? Because it's time for your Daily Helping. Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Daily Helping Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Richard, and our guest today is amazing. For nearly 3 decades, Kyle McDowell led tens of thousands of employees and managed multi-billion dollar businesses inside of corporate America's largest firms until he hit a wall. At the height of his career, success felt hollow, and that reckoning sparked a transformation. Out of it came the 10 Whys, a principle-based framework that turned into his Wall Street Journal and USA Today bestseller, Begin With We. Today, Kyle is known worldwide for helping organizations shift from a transactional culture to a transformational culture, replacing fear with courage, silos with collaboration, and bosses with authentic leaders. His straight-talking, deeply human approach has inspired audiences from Fortune 500 executives to professional athletes, and he's here today to share how purpose, integrity, and excellence can redefine leadership. Kyle, welcome to the Daily Helping. It is fantastic to have you with us today.
Dr. Richard, it is wonderful to be here. And what an introduction. I hope I live up to it. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I know that you will. There's no question in my mind. I've been so excited about this interview. You know, what I usually do with people who come on the show, because I'm so interested in the journey, right? As I ask them, you know, to jump in their DeLorean and go back, you know, in time to that kind of fracture point, that turning point. We talked about it in your intro, right? You hit a wall at the height of your career. But tell us why. What really was happening there?
Yeah. You know, I would venture to guess my story is not unique. I bet your listeners will find a lot of commonality in that. When I entered the workforce, man, I brought a lot of optimism. I had a plan. I wanted to find a place. I wanted to find a niche or a path for me that would enable a ton of impact. I wanted to find fulfillment. I wanted to do big things. And I always knew that I wanted to lead big organizations. And we could argue, and it wouldn't be a strong argument from my side, whether there were vanity metrics that were driving a lot of those goals. You know, the bigger the organization, the wider the scope, or the bigger the sphere of influence were the things that kind of motivated me, right, wrong, or indifferent. I'm the son of two very, very hardworking parents, both of whom have passed, but their work ethic inspired me from a very, very early age. I knew that I wanted X, I had to put in the effort. And I bet you can relate to this because I think we're about the same age. Every year, a new pair of Air Jordans would come out. I knew I had to hump it, whether it be 3 weeks worth of yard work or whatever it is my parents threw at me. They instilled very early on input and output, right? Nothing is free. Nothing's given. So I set off on this career journey where I wanted to find so much fulfillment and add value to whatever organization I would find myself. And it worked. You highlighted a few of the, you know, kind of the vanity metrics that I would say were in some ways proof points that my path and the, what I'd set out to accomplish, I was, by most standards, reasonably successful. The problem with the vanity metrics and kind of the optics of that bio that you were so kind to walk through is the untold side of that. So with every promotion, every new opportunity, I'm talking the sexy titles, you know, the fancy corner offices with their own conference room attached to them, all of these kind of trappings of the corporate world. With each successive kind of growth step, if you will, the only thing that matched that growth was my level of apathy. And you have to realize, Dr. Richard, and I'm sure you do, and it's not going to be a surprise to your audience, is that it's a hell of a gut punch to wake up and loathe the very environments that you were responsible for creating. And I reached this point, man, where it was like the apathy became so strong. And I started to look at my not just my professional life, but my entire life, my existence very differently, because I'd lost sight of those goals of fulfillment and passion and optimism. And I was on this hamster wheel and I was trading impact for a paycheck. And you're aware of this. There's so much toxicity and dysfunction either in pockets of essentially every organization, or it's even more rampant to where it's just kind of the status quo. And I observed that, I witnessed that, I perpetuated that. You know, I was a product of the environment that I kind of grew up in the corporate world. My corporate journey started at the age of 18. I applied for a role inside of a regional bank when I was 17, and I rolled the dice that if I were to get an offer, my birthday would pass and they would never know and they would hire me, and it worked out. And I saw this toxicity in pockets and I just kind of turned the cheek. And then I realized around year 20, probably 2022, and at the time I was leading a few thousand employees at a Fortune 10 firm, I had started to force myself to ask this very important question. And it took me a while to find the answer. And the question is there a better way? Is there a better way? Or does everybody have the same level of apathy that I had? And my first kind of step of addressing this question was asking those that I thought were kind of in my circle. You know, after 20-ish years, you kind of develop. I had a team and I had a couple fellas and one woman in particular who bounced with me from organization to organization, which is a really cool feeling. But when you ask, when I asked them, you know, am I alone in these feelings and kind of feeling disconnected from everything that we do, they told me what they thought I wanted to hear, because it turns out they feared me. They didn't respect me. They feared me. And when I mentioned I was a product of the environment I grew up in, the environment was to be effective as a boss, not really a leader. You bang your fist on the desk. You raise your voice. By any means necessary, we're going to accomplish the goal at hand. Whatever the metrics in front of us are, there were no other options. And how we got that out of people was probably not the most healthy, most productive. And certainly, I think the biggest cost was real connection. When you have people that you feel as if they're your confidants, but they're not telling you the truth, that was a gut punch. So I got out. I just reached a point where, you know, I don't want to come across naive. I was at a point in my career where I was fortunate enough to be able to step away. I mean, I wasn't independently wealthy, like I had to go back to work, but I was in this position where I was allowed to just kind of step away and get my head together, because I'd lost those desires. And I realized I needed to become the leader that I'd never been. I wanted to be the leader I never had. So it all came together. I was out of work for about 11 days when I was approached with an opportunity to lead about 15,000 people for a $7 billion program, really purpose-driven work. It was helping consumers enroll in the Affordable Care Act and running all the telephonic enrollments for 1-800-Medicare. Really, really important work. And I took the role because I sensed there was an opportunity to be the leader that I hadn't been historically. And I was right. There was an opportunity for a kind of a cultural reset, and there was a hunger for it. In a real be careful what you wish for moment, there was an epiphany for me. And it was the night before, I was about 60 days into the role. It was the night before I was to meet with the top 40 or 50 leaders of this newly inherited organization. And I was terrified. I didn't know what I was going to say, but I knew this was an opportunity for me to kind of distance myself from the leader of old. But it was a bit of a gamble, because I think by and large, I delivered. I was always the guy that would deliver. The gnarlier the problem, the better. So I was kind of rolling the dice if I were to take this turned out to be we-oriented, principle-driven approach versus command and control, would the results still be there? And would I be able to pick up the connections that I essentially didn't even care about or pursue the first 20-ish years? So that evening, I'm in my hotel room. I've got my laptop open. I think I was still wearing the suit that I had on earlier in that day. And I thought, well, I better create a few slides, because as you know, there's no good corporate meeting without a bunch of slides, right? So I'm sitting in this not very nice hotel room, and I just started to replay scenarios that left me feeling less than valued, that left me feeling as if I was just kind of a cog in this bigger machine, that whether I was here or not wouldn't really matter, but the impact would be negligible at best. And then I contrasted those experiences and feelings with the handful of times where I felt a lot of wind in my sails. I felt as if someone had really taken an interest in me, invested time in me, and ensured over and over that I was someone that was worthy of their attention, their time, and I was indeed adding value. And it was through that kind of mental exercise, I ended up with 10 sentences. And this is, I do kind of consider this an epiphany for me, because it changed the course of my professional life and ultimately my personal life and my being. these 10 sentences, they did and still do begin with the word we. And they turned out to be behaviors that, when widely communicated and conspicuous in your living of them, you send a message to those around you that this guy is not about a leadership gap. He's going to roll up his sleeves with us, and what's good for him is good for all of us. Dr. Richard, what unfolded over the course of the next couple of years is nothing short of profound. Business results reached all-time high in nearly every measurable. But what was more powerful to me and what fuels me today and ultimately compelled me to write my book is watching bosses transform into real leaders, which was a gamble that I knew if I was successful, the results would take care of themselves. But I also knew that if this new approach was less than successful, my career might be really at a crossroads, because I didn't want to go back to that environment that left me so apathetic. Those 10 sentences turned into the 10 we's, and they are my framework for essentially all things on this planet now. And they are the tools that I use to help leaders get out of their own way, become more collaborative, and connect with those around them in a way that in most cases they had not done prior.
So there's 10 of them, the 10 we's that emerged from that kind of reckoning, the apathy. Lucky though, only 11 days unemployed, that's pretty wild. But really, what was the first principle, the first of these we's that really shifted your own behaviors? And then how did you start seeing that ripple through teams that you led?
So my favorite and admittedly the most difficult for widespread embrace is we number 8, and that's we challenge each other. And there's a rule to this principle. They don't all have rules, but this one does. Challenges must be grounded in either data or experience. They can't be your opinion. We all have those, right? But to move the needle, we really need some type of almost objective input. But the spirit of this is not about how we challenge one another. It's the fact that we must challenge one another. And in most environments, challenges are reserved for one direction, the one with the most authority to those that don't have the authority. Where the value can be found in this principle, and by the way, the following principle is we number 9, we embrace challenge. You can't have one without the other. But when a team senses that they're not just filling orders or being prescribed what it is that they're supposed to do, they're not being dictated to, they're actually a part of the process for finding the optimal outcome. And that comes via them having not just the right, but the obligation to challenge their own peers, challenge me, the leader. And it's my responsibility to challenge up the organization as well. We start to get the best ideas on the table without fear of retribution if you didn't have everything kind of buttoned up, if you didn't have the most optimal scenario, but you said, you know what, this marketing campaign that we're about to launch, you know, I did this at a previous firm, and I got to tell you, we stumbled. Those are experiences we should listen to. We should hear that challenge out, and whether we proceed down that exact path or not is almost irrelevant, because we've opened the door for people to insert their experiences, their thoughts, and challenge us to find the best outcome. It was the most transformative for me, because when I first introduced those principles, I would say of the 40 or 50 people in the room that morning, half the group was really excited. I could sense the energy. A quarter of the group was kind of cautiously optimistic. They're like, okay, it's hard to refute these principles. And if he really lives it, I think we might have something here. And then there was the last group that was obstinate. You could just see they thought I was full of it. And I didn't take that personally, because they didn't know me. But they had seen guys like me come and go, have my own spin on my own leadership brand. And they just had seen it and weren't drinking the Kool-Aid just yet. In that group was a woman that was a direct report of mine, who was the most difficult of all. And she knows I tell the story because there is a happy ending. But she was in a public setting difficult. She would challenge me at every turn, in staff meetings, in focus groups, in front of other leaders, like in a way that was not as productive as it could have been. The old Kyle would have banged his fist on the desk and said, because I said so, let's move on. And for whatever reason, I knew that I was being watched in a way that my credibility and the likelihood of those trusting me and following what I was trying to build was going to be zero if they watched me not embrace her challenge, right? So when she threw difficult scenarios at me or challenged me or told me I was wrong, her delivery was not good. And the natural tendency, the ego-driven response that would have kind of driven how I would have behaved in those prior to those days would have just left my entire message DOA. Fast forward a number of years later, it was my embrace of challenge with Julia that I'm happy to share. We haven't worked together in a handful of years. We still have one-on-ones on a every 4 to 6 week basis. She's one of my closest colleagues. I bounce ideas off of her. She was there throughout the entire writing process. In fact, she even helped me name the book. And I think that's a testimony to, if we can look past the behavior and try to uncover why it is they're behaving the way that they're behaving, it's typically has very little to do with you. It's their experiences and they've been burned. And Julie was a classic example of that. When I left that organization, she ultimately assumed my role leading about 15,000 people. And she would be the first to tell you that it was these principles that changed how she viewed her role as a leader. It wasn't about checking boxes and managing things. It was actually about enabling folks to be better than they were the day before and watching all of us grow together, including her. You know, you asked the question of the most transformative or impactful to me. It's those two, without a doubt, because I think underlying everything I just said is it forced me to set aside the ego that had driven me the previous 20 plus years.
Hey guys, Dr. Richard here. For the past 7 years, I've been privileged to bring you incredible guests who are changing the world and can help you become the best version of yourself. I'm really excited to share with you a new quiz that I created based on my clinical training that will curate for you a custom list of my top episodes and actionable strategies to help you wherever you are on your journey. All you need to do is go to drrichardschuster.com to take it, and it's 100% free. You'll be taking the next step on the journey to unlocking the power of you, and I can't wait to see where you'll go. And what we often run into challenge-wise as leaders, and whether this is a leader in your household or your business, ego certainly, it's a part of it, right? Because we believe that we're the best and, you know, we're experts and we have to be that person. There's another part of this. You talked about Julia, and it made me think of, you know, when I used to see patients and they would be angry or upset, and the questions would be why, right? And so cognitive distortions, the things we tell ourselves, we don't know what Julia has been through, what she's experienced, but we are subconsciously and automatically going to make assumptions about her. And sometimes those assumptions are what lead us astray and lead us to create these opinions that are detrimental to moving a relationship forward and being successful. But my experience, and I'm sure this is Julia's a testimony to this, right? The ones who are the ardent, arms folded, the 25% who are obstinate, as you said, those become the true believers, right? Because if you can help them shift and see that you're willing to meet them halfway and listen, that changes everything.
Everything. You think the connections are not as strong when you've kind of, she wore me down. She wore me down in a way that I'm proud of, because it forced me to say, all right, I don't have to be the smartest guy in the room. I don't have to have the loudest voice. I don't need to have the answers. And it's like this silly metaphor that I've kind of dreamt up. It's like dancing. It's like slow dancing with someone else, or even fast dancing. When we're chest to chest, when I step back, what do? I've given you more room to step forward and really show your stuff. But if I'm right up against you, you're not able to flex and be the most creative dancer you can be. We need to give that space. As cliche and perhaps corny as it sounds, at the end of the day, we all want three things, I think, when it comes to our professional life. We want to add value. It's the ABCs. We want to add value. We want to be valued. And if we're really lucky, the C is we get to connect that value with those that ultimately kind of consume the product or service that we are a part of, right? It's so much more powerful to see the smile on someone's face or whatever it is you delivered. If you help someone at a closing table, if you work at a title insurance agency, you help someone at a closing table. I just gave a talk to a pretty big one here in Florida recently. Yeah, you could look at it as a transactional thing where I just help someone close on their new home. But if you look at it very differently, the impact that you're having, you've enabled a big step in their life, right? So when we look at our impact, and I think this is the best example that comes to mind at the moment, is that C, the connection part, is you can see the value that you're delivering in the smile of the people that you're helping with that closing. And I think it's a leader's obligation is to remember those ABCs and approach every day, essentially every interaction, with that in mind. The connections that you form, the cliche of, you know, I don't want anybody else in the foxhole with me except this group of people. And you talked about it before. I think you touched record about the value of having those that augment your strengths. those that can fill gaps of areas that you're either just not very good at or you don't even have an interest in. That's what happens, is you stepped away in that dance and you've allowed them to be their best, and there's no way the team doesn't benefit as a result. You don't have to have the spotlight. You don't have to be, that's not being a leader. Being a leader is not being the one that with the brightest light. It's the one that's shining the brightest light on others. And by the way, Dr. Richard, I recognize how cliche that sounds, but it is true.
I mean, human nature is human nature. The most important word to any person is their own name. And so if we are able to show them that we value them as people, it unlocks things in a really cool way. I'm curious, you know, I know we're kind of doing this out of order, and we've talked about 8 and 9, and I know there's 10 of the we's. We can't get through them all today. But even at a higher level, because you've been on stages, you've been all over the world, you talk about these 10 we's to large groups of people, you've worked to help implement them in large organizations. Doing this work, what have been some of the things that have really surprised you that you would not have expected?
The blurring of the line between professional and personal. So when I crafted the principles, the only lane for which I considered these principles was my leadership game. I was going to lead this big organization and try to maybe turn the corner, if you will. It wasn't a completely toxic place, but it definitely was ripe with opportunity. That was the singular focus. In fact, it was such a kind of myopic view of the impact that these principles could have that when I wrote my book, very close friends had no idea that these principles even existed. Because to me, there was work Kyle, and then there was personal life Kyle, and never the twain shall meet. Until I was, I gave a talk at Audi, and it's been maybe a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago now. And there were 70 executives in this auditorium style venue. And I'd gone through my spiel, right? Delivered a keynote. We were at Q&A, and there was a fella in the back who raised his hand and said, I called on him and he stood up. And I thought, boy, this might go south fast, because he was a big former Division I football player, had the Mr. Clean shaved head, just kind of an intimidating image. And he says, you guys, and again, 70 executives, he says, you guys, if you allow them to, these principles can change your life. Unsolicited. I didn't ask for this. And he says, and they have changed the way I'm raising my children. My reaction telling the story is not wildly dissimilar to my reaction at the time. It's overwhelming. I have chills telling the story. At that time, I teared up. I just lost my stage presence. And I was standing behind a podium at the time, and there was a stool there. I literally, which I never do, I sat on the stool and I said, I got nothing else, you guys. I got nothing else. I don't know how I can go any further than that. And I saw him well up a little bit. And it was at that moment I realized I am shortchanging the impact and the value that I can deliver if I focus only on the impact that these principles can have in the workplace. And that was an eye-opener for me because, and you know this probably better than anybody, the ability to be authentic as a leader goes a hell of a long way in your ability to establish trust. And if I'm behaving one way and holding myself to a series of standards inside the workplace, and I'm not outside of the workplace, I have now become a hypocrite, which I think is probably the biggest insult you could hurl at me. Kyle, you're a hypocrite. And we all have these little micro experiences or moments that if you choose to recognize it for what it is, it can be much bigger in terms of its impact on your existence. And for me, it was this. I was doing some grocery shopping. I go out to the parking lot. I checked out, go out to the parking lot, go to load my groceries in my truck. And I was that guy, Dr. Richard. I took my cart, just kind of rolled it over to the spot right next to my truck. And I left it there. I didn't take it back to the store. I didn't leave it in the little cart corral. Start to back out. And in my rearview mirror, and I see this cart start to slowly roll back as I'm pulling away. I said to myself, you are a hypocrite. I whipped my truck into the next parking spot, got out, moved that. Because if I'm the guy that's on stage, we number one is we do the right thing always. And if I'm the guy kind of evangelizing these principles and the value of holding yourself to higher standards or any standards for that matter, I am the definition of a hypocrite. It was that one little silly shopping cart experience that told me, and this was after the Audi talk, it told me that there's something much more important here than just trying to get bosses to become leaders. It's about establishing a standard that I'm going to hold myself accountable to in every relationship that I have. So now the 10 we's, these principles, they don't leave my brain for more than minutes at a time, because every day we're faced with situations that if we don't have a standard that we can anchor to, the likelihood of achieving that standard is zero. So it was, for me, it was a transformative moment. Those two moments were transformative in that I recognized, listen, man, if I want to approach my job in one way and get lots of fulfillment out of it, why would that not be applicable? Because we're just talking relationships, whether it's a good friend, my wife, family, whatever. We're just talking relationships. And every single relationship has an opportunity. You have an opportunity to add value to that relationship. You and I chatted about it a little bit before you hit record. It's not a nice to have. It's not a nice to have to be able to uplift someone else, to enable growth for them, to challenge them in ways maybe they've never been challenged. That's not a nice to have. Those are all human obligations. And it's the difference between approaching your work as a job versus more than a job. And it's similar to every other relationship we have. If we set standards and hold ourselves to them, there's no way that we're not contributing in a greater way to everything in which we are involved.
I love that, the shopping cart story. And it's funny, it's sometimes just these little things that happen to us, right? And when we're out of the office, and they have such a profound impact. And why I like what you do and why I wanted you on the show, because there's a lot of business leaders out there. You said it yourself. This is a book. These are principles that we can use as a compass for the relationships in our own lives. You know, and again, whether it's a job, whether it's a business we own, whether it's in our relationships with our significant others, our relationships with our kids, whomever it may be, these are principles that we can use as signposts. And what I also like about them is they're malleable to our own individual core values and beliefs, which I think that's the piece that so many people miss with these kind of things, is that somebody creates a framework. Awesome, right? Like, I've got a framework. You've got a framework. We all have frameworks. It's not enough just to say, okay, great. Well, I'm going to do this exactly the way Kyle McDowell does it, because you have to take these principles and apply them to your own values in your own life. And that to me is the magic, right? When you know, and for so many people, they don't know who they are, right? There are many people that if you put a gun to their head and said, tell me your values, they couldn't do it. And once you unlock that part of you and really understand your why and what makes you tick, then a framework like this allows you to do everything. I mean, your book called Begin With We, but beginning with we is really, to me, how do we understand each other's whys? We do that, we've got everything.
The observation of connecting these principles to values that you just exposed is really important. And when the book first came out and started to generate some momentum and we got those bestseller badges, some polite but firm pushback that I would hear from really senior leaders of big organizations is, well, we have our values, Kyle. We have our values. And they have these sexy, you know, integrity, service, commitment, all beautiful words that communicate our purpose externally. They tell those that we serve outside of our four walls what we want to be known for, but they're not actionable. And where I've found the principles to become incredibly transformative is when they are observable behaviors that enable the values. When you join a company and you learn the mission statement, which, by the way, more often than not on stage, I'll ask members of the audience, hey, raise your hand if your company has a mission statement. Of course, nearly every hand goes up. Keep your hand up if you can recite it. And you start to see some faster than others, but you see hands go down. And I think the reason for that is many organizations fall in love with their values and mission statements because they're usually beautifully crafted and they're words that nobody can refute. But here's the truth. They don't compel anybody to work more collaboratively. They don't compel anybody to work in a cohesive team environment. As a matter of fact, I think in many instances, they actually do more harm than good, because behind the curtain, people say, really, we value integrity? Well, I just had a meeting with a boss, you know, three layers more senior to me, and he was a jerk, or he was dishonest, or he was, you know, you could tell he was behaving in some nefarious or otherwise unappealing way. So that it actually can do more harm than good. But where the value that I have found with these principles is, they are observable behaviors and they enable those values. And I've had a couple of really big clients, multi-billion dollar firms, go through a really disciplined exercise to map each of the principles to their core values. So they can say, we're not just going to hang our hat on integrity. We're going to hang our hat in that we do the right thing always, or that we pick each other up, or that we embrace challenge, or we obsess over details, whichever the tent, they map them. And they've created a life of their own for these principles because they've connected them succinctly to their values. And one last thing on this, man. Let's not forget, a principle by definition is a fundamental truth. It's a foundation for a system of beliefs. And while most companies do a pretty good job saying, welcome to the team, here's how we're going to evaluate your performance, the X's and O's, the standard operating procedures, the what, they're painfully void of the how. The standard of behavior, our expectations, not just for how you do the work, or what you do rather, but how we interact with one another, how we hold each other accountable. If you can get a group of people to align on a series of fundamental beliefs and our system, our chain of reasoning for beliefs, there's nothing you can't accomplish. Because we're all kind of reading from the same hymnal and we have the same expectation of how we treat each other. Like one of my favorites is we say we're going to do and then we do it. Very simple, right? All of these principles are incredibly simple. Simple does not mean easy. So in this one, my favorite example is we're in a staff meeting. It's like, hey, Dr. Richard, can you bring that quarterly report to the next staff meeting? We'll have to dive into those numbers. Following meeting rolls around, Dr. Richard doesn't have the report. But he says, I emailed Sharon in accounting and I'm waiting to get that. Dr. Richard, you committed to this. And if I can't trust you to deliver on a commitment behind the scenes, how in the world can we trust each other to deliver excellence for those we serve outside of our four walls? It has to start behind the curtain. And when we hold each other to these standards, these fundamental beliefs, we unlock a whole hell of a lot of potential that otherwise is kind of these chaos, what I would call the chaos of unspoken expectations. Everybody kind of goes at it their own way. They have different standards for how we behave. And that's a recipe for disaster.
This time together, God, it's flown by so quickly. As you know, Kyle, I love to wrap up every episode by asking my guests just this one question. And that is, what is your biggest helping? That one most important piece of information you'd like somebody to walk away with after hearing our conversation today.
I would love for people to remember there is a better way. My story is not unique. My relationship with apathy is far from unique. Over time, we become conditioned. This hamster wheel becomes our identity. And if we're going to work, on average, each of us work about 100,000 hours of our lifetime. This thing called work. You won't do anything more in this lifetime other than sleep. So if you value or you like this notion of our human obligation to add value, regardless of the scenario, to leave a place or a person better off than that place or that person was when you found them, there is a better way. You don't have to be on the hamster wheel. I'm not naive. This approach is not embraced in all environments. And that should force us to ask questions. Is this the environment for me? But don't succumb to this big engine, this machine. I've run those big machines. And I'm telling, before and after this transformation, I'm telling you the value that you'll find, and more importantly, the fulfillment and impact that you'll find, is really worth pursuing that better way.
The book is called Begin With We and is available everywhere books are sold. We'll have a link to it in the show notes. But Kyle, if people want to learn more about you, where can they find you online?
That's very kind of you to ask. The book, as you've mentioned so graciously a number of times, Begin With We, it's available wherever books are sold. My website is kylemcdowellinc.com. And I'm on essentially every social media platform with a similar handle, at Kyle McDowell Inc. And I use that as an absolute, it's my communication medium. And what I've found either via keynotes or whatever the interactions are, a lot of people aren't comfortable asking the questions that they really want to ask. So I respond to every single direct message, and I use it as a way for myself and my team to get better, but also, you know, have more of a one-on-one experience for those that would like one.
I love that. For those of you on the road, we got you covered. Everything Kyle McDowell will be linked in the show notes at drrichardschuster.com. So check that out. Kyle, man, this was a great time today. Thank you so much for joining us and spending a bit of your day with everyone here listening.
What a pleasure, man. You're doing really important work, and it's an honor to be on the show with you. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate that. And I appreciate each and every one of you as well. If you took time out of your day to listen to this, thank you. If you liked it, if you learned something, if you're going to start implementing these 10 we's in your life, give us a follow and a 5-star review in your podcast app of choice, because that's what helps other people find this show. But most importantly, go out there today and do something nice for somebody else, even if you don't know who they are, and post in your feeds using the hashtag MyDailyHelping, because the happiest people are those that help others.